You're listening to The Afternoon Magazine. I'm your host for the next hour, Todd Gleason, setting in for Celeste Quinn, who's away this afternoon. This morning, if you were listening to the first hour of Focus 580, David Inge's program, you heard me discussing a brand new book called Biologist in the Field, Stories, Tales, and Anecdotes from 150 years of field biology. We'll continue on that vein just a bit this afternoon, because the book was mostly about those field biologists that have and continue to work for the Illinois Natural History Survey, but we'd like to talk more about the survey itself, celebrating 150 years of existence. In studio with us this afternoon is the director of the survey. His name is Brian Anderson. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
And Sue Post, who is co-author of the book and was along with us this morning, is back. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Todd.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about what's been happening with this 150th anniversary of the Illinois Natural History Survey. Does it kick off with an expo, or is there an expo that's involved?
There's an expo that's involved. No, it kicks off tomorrow with a scientific symposium. I believe we have 13 speakers. The symposium runs from 9 to 5:30 with our capstone speaker, Peter Ravens.
Yeah, Peter will be there at 4:30.
Oh, yeah.
And so it'll probably run through about 5:30.
Oh, right. We can, and later on in this afternoon, in fact, I did an interview with Peter already. It'll sound a bit like I'm live with him this afternoon, but it's pre-recorded. He was off to China, so I didn't get a chance to interview him live at this point. But later this afternoon, in the second half hour of the closing market report, about 2:25 Central, we'll talk to him about the biodiversity of the planet and what he thinks about plants and animals and carbon sequestration, all kinds of things. Should be interesting. What time does he speak tomorrow and where?
4:30, and he's actually at the auditorium at the I Hotel, which is on South Campus, 1900 First Street. So it'll be a real treat. He's a fascinating guy, a world-renowned, we're really looking forward to it.
Is this open to the public?
Yes. Yes. All of our events are open to the public at no cost.
Nope. Yeah, I was going to say they're
all free. This is an opportunity for us to, thank the community and the people of Illinois. So we wanted to kind of give something back on
your 150th
years. 150th, yeah.
All right. And then there's an expo that is involved as well. Right. What is it?
Prior to the expo on Saturday, we have Mark O'Shea, who's a herpetologist, television personality from the Animal Planet, and author, and he's going to be speaking on serpents, sorcery, and snake bite in Papua New Guinea in the land of the unexpected. And he's going to be giving 2 45-minute talks. This, again, is open to the public. He's also authored several books, and we'll have some of those available for purchase, and he will sign them after he speaks.
Yeah, and that is where?
That, again, is at the I Hotel, 1900 South First.
Yeah, so if you haven't been to the I Hotel, it's easy to get to. It's just south of the Assembly Hall. Brand new building, and it's on the same side of the street, relatively speaking, as you're going south on First Street, as the Assembly Hall and the football stadium. Easy to find, and a really nice place, too.
Yeah, beautiful facility, and we're really pleased. We're one of the first groups to really have a large event there. So it was completed just in time, just for us.
Sure. Well, let's hope it goes well. Sometimes it's not good to be first. Sometimes it's really good to be first. So you'll get to find out, won't you?
Absolutely.
So Mark will be speaking from about 10 to 11:30. Mm-hmm. And then at 12 noon, our expo kicks off. And our expo is going to be held at our headquarters on Oak Street, 1816 South Oak, and we'll be there from 12 to 6. We're saying we have about 50 exhibits. 40 of those are manned by scientists. And Joe Spencer and I were talking after the program this morning, and we're saying that our book in the field, it's stories about what biologists do, because, you know, people really, really don't know what we do. Well, we're thinking the expo is really going to help maybe take some of the mystery out of what biologists do.
Because people can come and see and listen and hear and watch you tell those tales in person.
Not only can they do that, but there's going to be a lot of hands-on activities for them. So they'll get to do radio tracking of reptiles and amphibians and birds. They can see what it's like to seine, or how do we catch fish. I think it's kind of cool. What our collections are doing, or what our entomologists are doing, we have a lot of unknown specimens, insects that have never been named. They're going to describe those, and we're going to have a drawing. And if your name's drawn, you get to give it the scientific name.
Oh, no way.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Very cool.
Really?
Yeah.
And how do you register a scientific name then once it's done?
Oh, it has to be published. And it, frankly, the rules associated with naming things are very complex. You have to be the first one that names it. And of course, scientific names have two parts, the genus and the species. And so the genus will be predetermined. But
right.
The species name is something that you can assign, and they'll probably have to add a little piece of Latin on the end. But otherwise, you can choose the name.
Et al.
Yeah.
And then, see, it would have your name in parentheses as you were the one that named it. So
yeah.
It would be like Gleason.
And this would go down into history.
Yeah.
You would be forever famous. So.
Oh, so this you can do at the expo. Again, where is this building? It's on Oak Street.
It's actually Oak Street. If you go down St. Mary's Road, again, south of the Assembly Hall.
Mm-hmm.
As you're coming from Neal Street, it's the second right turn. It's
mm-hmm.
the first. It's the stop sign. The first stop sign you hit when you're going east.
Oh, right.
On St. Mary's.
I'd forgotten that you moved on campus. So
right.
This
yes.
is where
yes.
this is where Sue, you're and Mike Jeffords' offices
and
are.
Joe Spencer
and Joe Spencer's are all
yeah.
out there. So if you know. Where
and you'll see a big research park sign.
Yeah, the research park is
yeah.
out there.
And there'll be signs directing people. And
Yahoo
we're right across from the iHotel.
Yeah, and right across from the iHotel. So that should be fun. There'll be big signs. And
signs.
And what time does it run again?
12 to 6.
12 to 6 on
Saturday.
Saturday,
Saturday only, and it's free.
Good for kids?
Excellent for kids. A lot of hands-on activities for kids and adults.
We've really gone out of our way to really design this for families. So it's a great opportunity to bring the kids out. There'll be special things for the children to do, but also we think enough content that the parents will be fascinated too.
All right. Well, it's all part of the 150 years of the work that the Illinois Natural History Survey has done. Can you give me a timeline or talk a little bit about the work and how the Illinois Natural History Survey was founded, why it's
sure.
in place, those sorts of things?
Well, it goes back, of course, to 1858. It was actually originally founded as the Illinois Natural History Society, and it originally started out at Normal University over in Bloomington. After a couple of years, I think it was 1861, the General Assembly actually sanctioned the Illinois Natural History Society. For about 20 years, we really went into the mode of developing collections, going out and inventorying all the plants and animals of Illinois and developed quite a significant museum. And really, the Illinois Natural History Museum became the focus in those early years. Finally, after Stephen Forbes, who is one of the foundation people in ecology, after he came to the survey, it became the Natural History Survey Laboratory. And then in 1885, once it became a laboratory, it really started to take all that data from the collections, and we started to do research on plants and animals of Illinois, how they live, how they need to be managed. And in 1885, the Natural History Laboratory came to the University of Illinois campus when Forbes joined the faculty here at the University of Illinois. And we've been on campus ever since. Through the years, sometimes we were associated or administratively attached to the university, to various state agencies. And just recently, July 1st of this year, the General Assembly moved us back to become part of the University of Illinois again. We and our sister surveys are now in the Institute of Natural Resource Sustainability. So not only are we celebrating this incredible 150th anniversary, we're really opening a new chapter in our history, and we're all excited about the opportunities it's going to present to work with other colleges and departments on campus. So it's an exciting time, both as we look back and as we look forward.
Well, as a lowly representative of the University of Illinois, welcome back.
Well,
it's really
you.
Good
thanks,
to have you.
Thank
but,
you.
But I always thought probably that you were involved in the university in a great way.
Well,
but and not a separate way, but a very intertwined way as
mm-hmm.
it was. And I think
yeah.
that's probably the case.
Yeah, that's true. We've been on the campus again since 1858. We have pretty much always done our research through the auspices of the Board of Trustees of the University of Illinois. So we did have some what we call general revenue funding or state support that came through state agencies. But what we do, and we do really well, is we then leverage that funding. Usually for every state dollar we receive, we go out and find grants, extramural funding, 3-to-1. So our budget is about 4 times what we receive from the state. And, of course, we do a lot of work that benefits the citizens, but also those dollars are plowed back into the community to have some pretty significant local economic benefits as well.
That's not easy to do. I'd like to know how you do that, but I also want to invite listeners to join our conversation this afternoon. If you want to talk to Brian Anderson, the director of the Illinois Natural History Survey, or Susan Post, entomologist, biologist, they're on hand with us this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. The number is to call 217-333-9455. That's WILL. Or toll free 800-222-9455. 217-333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You told us that you can take the dollars you get and make them 4 times as great, but you didn't tell me how many dollars you get. So how big's the budget?
Well, at the Natural History Survey, it's about a little over $3 million. About $3.2 million a year. So, and whereas our budget is well over $12 million. So we do a pretty good job of leveraging those dollars. And
that can't be easy. You must have some really talented grant writers, I would think.
Well, we have great scientists. And, you know,
well, and great scientists, too.
I mean, they really, national reputations. I've always found it interesting. I actually came to Illinois in 1985. I had been working in Kentucky, went to school in Indiana, grew up in Michigan. I had heard of the Illinois Natural History Survey my entire life because I was interested in the outdoors and ecology. When I got here, I realized that in many ways, the surveys are better known in other states, and they are here in our own state. And that's something we really want to correct, because we have world-class scientists doing stuff that's benefiting not only our own citizens, our fish and wildlife and our economy, but other states benefit from the research we're doing as well. So I think that's one of my goals in the next 150 is to become as well known in Illinois as we are around the world.
Well, you have to move 50 miles off the border then.
Yeah, probably.
Probably so. Hey, do you have a stated mission for the survey?
Yeah, our focus is really research, education about the fish and wildlife resources of Illinois, the living resources of Illinois. That's our entire focus, and we've done it very, very well, and as we move into the future, again, being here at the university, we have a lot, I think, more opportunity to help educate our citizens about those resources, so to share that research and also make it more applied, more on the ground. So I'm hoping we're going to be able to get our message out more now that we're part of the university.
As a taxpayer, as a citizen who lived and grew up on a farm and understands some of the ecology of it, then as somebody who lives and works in town now, why should I care about these surveys or what's there in Illinois? Does it make that much of a difference?
Well, I guess there are different levels at which you can look at that. The first thing probably, and because of my own love of the outdoors, we're very directly involved in ensuring that a lot of our native plants and animals don't disappear. So first, we're trying to make sure that Illinois resources are sustained. The second consideration is an economic one. We're very involved in doing research that helps, for example, the Department of Natural Resources regulate hunting and fishing, which provides a lot of income to the state. We're very directly involved with a lot of federal agencies, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, helping them manage their refuges in the state.
Is that all about data collection on both of those counts so that you...
Data collection and analysis. Science is, first of all, you got to get out there on the ground and do the hard work of collecting the data.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's a little step in there that the difference between a good scientist and a great scientist, I tell people, is magic. It's having it's having that intuition where you look at the data, you see patterns, and you start to ask questions like, could this be going on or could that be going on? And so it's that analysis piece that's really important in science. And then publishing it, making sure that that information, that new science gets shared with the world. So it's kind of a three-step phase. And if a scientist falls down at either one of those, they're not going to be a very good scientist.
This afternoon, we're talking with Brian Anderson and Sue Post. Both are with the Illinois Natural History Survey. Urging you to give us a call if you'd like to join the conversation. The numbers are 217-333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We do have a caller on line one from Champaign. Good afternoon to you. Do you have a question or comment that you would like to make this afternoon?
Actually, I'm just curious. I'm interested in the actual work that biologists do, and you may have covered this earlier, are you the main or only entity in the state or your type of entity that employs practicing biologists, i.e. those that go out in the field?
Well, we're not the only ones. We mm-hmm. focus, most of our people are focused strictly on research. A lot of biologists are also employed in educational institutions. Many of them, beyond their teaching mission, they'll teach classes and they're training the next generation of scientists. But they will also do curiosity-driven research, focusing in their area of specialty. But the researchers at the Natural History Survey, research is their full-time job every day.
I see.
There's also another group of biologists that work in a lot of the agencies, whether it be the Departments of Natural Resources, the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Transportation, even Todd here.
Well, not me, but College of Aces, of course.
Absolutely. At the University College of Aces. Those folks, a lot of them are very applied. They will take the research and the science that's been generated, and they will apply it in management on the ground every day. Mm-hmm. So our folks, for example, at Natural History Survey, we do a lot of work on studying game fishes, on studying animals that are harvested like deer and turkey. We don't actually then do the management of those resources. That day-to-day work is done by the biologists that are in those agencies. So it is a mix, and you will find that some folks will move from teaching to research for a while, maybe a more applied role, and then back into teaching. So there was really a lot of opportunity for young scientists, and that's another thing we're hoping that this expo will excite some kids about becoming a scientist.
Right.
Because we're facing a situation where a lot of scientists who are in that baby boomer generation are going to retire, and it's going to be really hard to replace them. It's particularly difficult because the math and science skills that are needed to pursue those kinds of degrees, we're finding that's where we're having trouble in our schools, is getting students to really embrace that math and science. So we want to get some kids excited because we've got to replace that generation of scientists who's going to be leaving the workforce.
Mm-hmm. So these are mainly public entities?
Primarily. There are, private colleges and universities that hire biologists as well. There are also a lot of nonprofit organizations like the Nature Conservancy, Prairie Rivers Network, a lot of environmental organizations that also employ professional biologists.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Pleasure. Thank you very much. A couple of other places, of course, the College of Aces. I can think, just off the top of my head, entomology on campus, mm-hmm. which would count this. So May Barenbonham Company are a separate entity on campus at the mm-hmm. University of Illinois, and then Aces. We have entomologists, Mike Gray and Kevin Steffi, and then you folks over at the Illinois Natural History Survey, and there are a whole Passel of you, Mike Jeffords and Sue Post and mm-hmm. Joe Spencer and others are entomologists, but there are a whole lot of other folks. Weed scientists. I was out with the group from ARS, the Agricultural Research Service.
Well, Marty and Adam.
And Marty and Adam. Mm-hmm. Marty and Adam Davis. I was out with them yesterday morning at Illini Grove, and we were with Adam at least, looking at garlic mustard, right?
Yeah.
I have that same research project, only I'm doing mine in Peoria County. It's exactly what Adam's doing.
Invasive species, mm-hmm. but in a different county. So we were looking at garlic mustard, and he does a lot of science and mathematics with his its demographics, a
right.
huge
mm-hmm.
amount of demographics mm-hmm. about where this invasive species is. And then we were working the other one was on sweet corn, and because sweet corn varieties aren't very tolerant of herbicides that are available, but they're also really not tolerant of weed species as well. And so those are all kinds of folks that are working on behalf of the citizens and, I suppose, behalf of some of the corporations, relatively speaking, because they take the programming content and roll that into their own research, where they have biologists that are looking at all these sorts of things. We do have somebody on line 4 from Terre Haute that would like to join our conversation this afternoon. Thanks for calling in from Indiana. You have a question today?
I have a couple of questions. I'm not sure if the topic's right or not, but I wondered what the status of the badger was in Illinois, and also what you could tell me about what I call a velvet ant, which would be red and black, and has quite a sting.
Sue, you got comments on the ant, I bet, and maybe even the badger.
The velvet ant, it's a member, it's an ant, so it's a member of the Hymenoptera. Only the female will sting you. So if I were you, though, I would not pick either one of them up, because you don't know whether it's a male or a female.
How widespread are they? I don't see them very often.
You usually don't see them very often, and a lot of times where I see them, it's in sandy soils, so they seem to like a more porous soil than what at least I'm used to here in central Illinois, although I do know a colleague does have them on her property near Tolono. Is the one you see like orange and black, or is it sort of the tan and black one?
I call it red and black. I was a small boy. It was mm-hmm. very pretty, and I picked it up, and I got a heck of a sting.
You picked up a female.
I was dumb enough to do it as an adult, too.
Oh.
But do they have any natural predators?
Ooh, I can't really think of any offhand. That's just something I've tried rearing them before, and it's really hard because they like honey water, and so then they get stuck in the honey and they get all their hairs clogged, so you have to kind of wash them off. But
a lot of birds actually will eat ants, attack ants. They actually will do something called anting, where they run various kinds of insects that can sting or burn them through their feathers to reduce the load of feather lice, of all things. So it would not surprise me that if some of the birds would not attack that creature. But I'm not sure their purpose is really to eat them as much as it is to maybe perhaps use
them. I read one place where they call them cow killers.
That's one of their common names is cow killer.
Because of the sting?
Right, just because of the sting. They're not going to actually kill the cow.
They might buck a lot.
Right.
Yeah, they sting really, really bad.
And you had mentioned the badger. I hope you're not picking any of those up.
No.
They were moving in from the west and southwest, and I know that we're continuing to monitor their spread.
In 1989, we first began a survey to see how many badgers there were in Illinois, and I think they've pretty much spread. You can find them in quite a few of the counties. So the populations are greater than we once thought.
Okay. They're just nocturnal, so you don't really see them that often.
Right. You're usually going to see them towards dusk or dawn. And again, they really like, it seems, more the sandy, friable soil.
Okay.
So
my neighbor swears we have one in the backyard.
Oh, no kidding.
Thank you from Terre Haute. Yeah, no, she does. And I just assumed, I saw a groundhog, so I assumed she got it wrong, but maybe so. I didn't think we had badgers in this part of the state or in this part of the world.
Somebody just turned in a roadkill badger a couple weeks ago, and it was found, I think, on I-74 or I-57. So it was from Champaign County.
Hmm. Well, maybe indeed. I'll have to make sure my dog, which is really small, stays out of the backyard more than that. We have somebody on line two from Urbana that's been patiently waiting to join the conversation. Good afternoon to you.
I want to thank you for this call-in show. It's so great to learn about these programs on campus and in the area. But I just had a small comment early on that I was wondering if somebody might want to reach to. Early on, somebody had responded to the question about grant writers, and the response, I'm wondering if you want to reframe it a little, because I'm sure you do have great scientists, but perhaps there's something you want to say about the people, the grant writers and others on your support staff who help provide the resources needed for your scientists to just go out there and be able to focus on doing such great work. So I'm just wondering if you wanted to readdress that question.
Well, actually, most of the scientists are writing at the Natural History Survey are actually writing the grants themselves. We provide support staff in terms of the fiscal management of projects. But we have in the past had grant writers, and I got to tell you, they're a wonderful asset. I mean, you can just really tap many, many sources of more sources of funding when you have those kinds of specialists available. Unfortunately, with some of the tough economic times, unfortunately, some of the grant writers are the first to go, and that burden does then fall back on the scientists. So that's something we sure would like to be able to do in the future, is provide that kind of support. And I don't know, for those of you who've never written grants, it is an art. I mean, the second one is a lot easier than the first one, and the 100th is a lot easier than the first 50. You do develop skills. You learn to know what granting agencies are looking for, and again, it's something that we really would like to. It's a kind of support we'd really like to, again, provide our scientists. But right now, I don't think we have anyone who's specializing just in grant writing for us.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Really great scientist. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. And I suppose I made that leap that you probably had really good grant writers and that some of them were the scientists. But I work enough with the scientists on campus that I understand how many grants they have to work, and that having somebody who's a really good grant writer helps bring in the money. And you were bringing in so many extra dollars that I made the assumption, I guess, that you had grant writers, but you just have great scientists there. I happen to be good grant writers.
That's right.
Hey, speaking of the great scientists and things that they do that are unique, a couple of things that I've been involved in over the years, and I don't know whether they still operate. Is insect theater still around?
We did insect theater. We did a show or performance last fall. We're not having one for this expo. We just thought, well, we have so many other things to focus on that we won't be doing insect theater, but maybe we'll do a revival.
You came into my studio over in Mumford Hall. Do you remember doing this?
I still have the tape.
You still have the tape or CD?
I have tapes. I have CD.
There are some good tunes in that one.
Oh, those are some favorites.
All
but
right.
It's always popular with the audiences, so I'm sure it's not going to die.
And I suppose that opens up to other outreach types of programs that you do. There are a couple of them that I can think of. I've seen Michael Jeffords in the school. I don't recall what that mobile unit is and whether it's still around.
We have both the Mobile Science Center and we have the Traveling Science Center. Both the Mobile Science Center and Traveling Science Center will be at our expo on Saturday. The Mobile Science Center is mainly, it's called arthropods. It's mainly about insects and the role of arthropods in the environment. And the Traveling Science Center is about the biodiversity of the Chicago region. And that is usually, that's where its base is the Chicago region.
And is this the unit that sometimes goes out to schools and you do some teaching?
Of the units will go out to schools. The mobile unit has not gone out to schools this year, but the traveling one is usually out 2-3 days a week.
So teachers call you and ask for it? How do they find out about it?
They usually call the Natural History Survey. Usually it's Michael Jeffords or Charles Helm. Charlie retired from the survey, and he's the mobile science center driver and also educator. So he drives it and sets it up and is the person that gives the content information. He's excellent. He's a retired entomologist, and he's just excellent at it.
I bet he wrote good grants, too.
Yeah. And let me make a special pitch to teachers out there. Come to the expo. Look at some of the resources available. We really would like to reach out especially to teachers and make them aware of some of the resources that are available and some of the resources that can be brought to their classroom. Because, as I said, training young people in the sciences is really something that's incredibly important right now.
And then once those kids get a little older, I suppose they can move from that maybe to the Illinois Wilds Institute for Nature, right?
We like 16 and up for Illinois Wilds Institute for Nature, although if you have a child that's younger, usually with the grandparent.
Well, I said a little older. I meant high school age and up, really.
Okay. But that's mainly for, we found adults. And several people have said that it just makes them feel like kids again. It's like summer camp for kids, where we have field classes in entomology. Our most popular one happens to be reptiles and amphibians. We do natural history of areas. We just finished one in July on the natural history of what we call the Lost Mound area, which is in northwestern Illinois near Galena. We have a field station there, and we looked at dragonflies, butterflies, and skippers, and also the ecology of the area.
Yeah, one of the first things I did when I came to the survey, and I've only been there since May 1st, but I had a chance to go up to the IWIN program on dragonflies and mayflies, and I had a wonderful time. You know, I'm already a bird watcher, and now I find that I have to choose. Do I look at the birds or do I look at the dragonflies? It's just fascinating. Just a fascinating. Well,
they're all great outreach programs.
Mm-hmm.
They really are. I guess in a tie to our conversation this morning and part of the 150th anniversary, it sort of gives people the idea that they can come out and be a biologist for the day, or you can read about them in the book, Biologist in the Field.
Right.
And you can pick that up at the expo, too.
Right, right. We will have our books on sale. And one of the stories in there is about the IWIN field classes, and one of the IWIN participants made up a little poem. He said, "I win, you win. We all win with I win."
All right. Well, let's get back to a little heavier conversation again. I want to talk about data collection and how that happens, and then some of the problems that we may face in the near future, but also remind folks that they can call in with their questions or comments this afternoon about the Illinois Natural History Survey if you want to do that. The numbers to call are 217-333-9455. That's WILL, 217-333-9455, or toll free at 800-222-9455. That's 222-9455. Put an 800 in front of it, and you'll be toll-free and talking with Brian Anderson and Susan Post of the Illinois Natural History Survey. There's a whole lot of folks that will be retiring over the coming years.
Yes.
That have done a lot of data collection. And you talk just a little bit about the money crunch. Mm-hmm. And it's quite likely that a lot of them may not be replaced in the very near future, at least for a while. So that may create some problems in all kinds of places in terms of data collection and then data archiving.
Absolutely. The baby boomer generation is so large, and you know, there are some incredible statistics about how many boomers are retiring every second now. And one of the most valuable things in science are these data sets, particularly ones that are long-term. One of the great strengths of the Natural History Survey has been its collections, which our first insect, I think, was collected in 1860. But the raw data that a scientist collects, certainly they do analyses of it. They publish a lot of papers associated with it. But that raw data can be looked at in the future by other scientists. And since we don't know what kinds of challenges are biodiversity going to face in the future? For example, you mentioned the issue of exotics. Exotic invasive species, the pace at which we are seeing those invaders has really picked up since we've entered this period of globalization. Sometimes you can go back and look at a data set that covers that's 40 or 50 years old, and you can learn things from it that would be impossible if that data goes away. And as scientists retire, we're beginning to worry about what we call orphan science, collections that their college or university don't feel like they want to continue to maintain because they don't have a faculty member working in that area, or this basic data that has been collected and maintained over the career of a scientist, to just lose it, I think, is a real shame. And so one of the things we've been talking about is perhaps at the Natural History Survey trying to focus on becoming a center where we try and archive, to capture and at least archive that data for future use by scientists, which we haven't even trained yet.
Orphan data sets. So these could be just numbers, or they could be sheer very large collections of all kinds of things. The one that comes to the top of my mind, and I don't know whether it found a home or not, we have soil samples here on campus from before the turn of the century, a lot of them in glass jars from all over the state.
And
that's before herbicides and pesticides and the nuclear bombs and all kinds of things.
Absolutely. In fact, there have been a number of studies where people have actually gone back to these sealed glass containers and extracted, for example, the air from those containers and done analyses of air quality then versus now. Now, who would have thought back then that was an application that would ever evolve? With DNA work, some of these collections of insects, you can actually sometimes extract data, depending on how the specimen was preserved, and do analyses of animals, their genetics from 100 years ago. It would be a shame to lose that kind of scientific information.
Yeah, and maybe we should talk about how those things are lost and what happens. So it's really that because the academic world, and I suppose the Illinois Natural History Survey world as well, works sort of all together but all in their own little cubicles at the same time. Somebody said it's like herding cats to get academics to go in one direction, but everybody collects their own things and they keep them themselves a lot of the time.
In many places, historically, that has been the pattern. Now, there is clearly a trend. The days of having the great discoveries occurring as a result of the work of one person are starting to pass away. We're doing a lot more collaborative research. We're developing research groups. And frankly, because of our friends in information technology, we're learning that when we do that, we have to make sure we also archive the data of those collaborative research groups. But as you said, many scientists still have their personal interests. They have data that they keep and maintain, and there's a danger it could be lost.
Well, tell me about some of the collections that the Illinois Natural History Survey now has in its possession. What kind of collections do you have?
We've got insects, birds, mammals, one of the largest mussel collections in the Midwest,
crayfish.
Mm-hmm. We even have annelid worms, segmented worms. We cover almost all groups of plants and animals as well. We're also building a new facility to house our plant collections. So that's something we're very excited about. But we have one of the largest herbaria in the country as well. So we cover a pretty broad spectrum. This is, again, kind of something we've specialized in. We've done some really interesting work in our insect collections. Of course, you have individual insects that are pinned and labeled. They're in little trays that fit in shelves. We have some folks working on photographing a whole tray of insects at different angles and then using computers reconstructing all the information on the label, the name of the species, where it was collected, and then having the computer automatically enter it into databases. So instead of having to hand transcribe that data from every specimen so that we can database it and then share it with other specialists all over the world, we're learning to use information technology, automation, to make that a less expensive and a quicker job.
Boy, and it sounds a bit like you'll be able to see some of those insects modeled in 3D right on your computer page, too, or at least see them in several different view places.
Exactly. In fact, Susan can tell you a little bit. We actually do some model building. And
We work with the Office of Computers on campus. We have made 3D insects using images that they have given us. So they've made the 3D, then we create the 3D models. And one of our most popular ones is our hellbender. It's a large, giant salamander found in flowing streams, usually under rocks. It's pretty much, they haven't found one in Illinois in a very long time, but you can find them in the more southern states.
And it's popular just because it's neat looking, or?
It's used as an education tool. So this model is realistic, life-size, and it comes with an educational booklet with activities and information about the species. So they use them in nature centers, parks, zoos. We've sold over 75 of these.
Oh. You know, another one that we've been doing is the emerald ash borer.
Emerald ash borer, right.
This is a new pest. A new pest species, and the original insect is only what? Under an inch?
Right, about under an inch.
And the model that we've generated, again, using lasers and all that stuff, is probably a foot and a half long. So we provide these models to people so that they can learn to identify the invader, so that we can track how this invasion of this exotic is unfolding across the country and develop management strategies, hopefully, to halt the impact on the ash trees in the country.
Well, just a few minutes left. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can do that at 217-333-9455 or 222-9455. The 800 in front of that makes it toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you can do that just like our caller from Strasbourg has this afternoon. Good afternoon to you. How are things in Strasbourg this afternoon?
Am I on here?
You are indeed.
Okay, two questions. I'm a farmer. I'm out cutting beans right now. And of recent years, there's been a fungicide that's been promoted to help the yield and the health and whatnot of a corn plant. And I heard about a year ago that there was some kind of impact on hummingbirds from that particular fungicide. I'd be curious if you had any information on that. And I'll hang up and listen to you on the radio.
Well,
thank you very much
for calling in from the Combine Cab. I hope the yields are good in Strasbourg this afternoon. That's not one that I've heard about,
and I'm usually pretty close to those sorts of things.
But I would love to find out more about this. So if our caller could give me a call at the Natural History Survey, that number is area code 217-333-6830. I'd like to know more what fungicide we're talking about and look into that in a little more detail.
So give him a call at 333-6830. You can probably just do that now and leave him a voicemail message
exactly.
If you like, and he'll get back to you at 6830. We have another listener, I believe. Is that on line one this afternoon? And is that right? Do we have line one? Good afternoon to you.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I had a question on, is there anything progress being made on developing the Asian carp as a commercial fishery?
Well, you know, I keep hearing rumors that there are businesses thinking about coming in and harvesting. One of the rumors that was out there floating around was that there was a company who was interested in isolating some of these omega-3 fatty acids that are anti-cancer agents, which are in a lot of fish oils. We've also heard rumors that some folks are thinking about coming into the area along the Illinois River and perhaps harvesting these fish to be used as fertilizer. I suspect right now, because of the situation in the economy, it's kind of hard to capitalize those kinds of projects. But there's I hear constant rumblings, and I do think that, frankly, it's a matter of time before we try to capitalize. I think this is one of this invader is so pernicious. The density, the number of actual fish, and the volume of fish per mile of river is just amazing. And so we're hoping that some of our research is actually going to stimulate some folks to actually invest in that kind of a venture, because with this one, I don't know how we're going to otherwise deal with it. We are, though, one of the things that is going on is there is an electric barrier in northern Illinois trying to keep these fish from getting into the Great Lakes. A pilot was built, and the Corps of Engineers is working right now. We're hoping to build a full-scale facility to halt that invasion up into the Great Lakes.
All right. Well, thanks to our caller. We're just really out of time. That's a son of a gun of fish. If you haven't seen one of those in person, the first time I saw one was years ago, and when she jumped, it scared me.
Yeah.
My experience with the Asian carp happens to be in the field.
Oh, does it?
I was smacked by one last year.
Oh, in the face or in the head? Yeah, mm-hmm. They jump. Were you in a canoe or a flatboat?
Yeah. I was in a boat.
Yeah, they jump about head high coming out of there, and man, they can... That scared me when they came up. That's a son of a gun. So we probably ought to recap very quickly what kinds of things we have coming up in the next several days to celebrate the 150th anniversary.
We have our Natural History Symposium, the title, Conservation of Natural Resources in the 21st Century, A View from Illinois, and it begins at 9 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And that's at what we call the I Hotel, 1900 South 1st Street. And our capstone speaker will be Peter Raven, mm-hmm. and he will be speaking at 4:30. We then, on Saturday at 10 o'clock, Mark O'Shea will be speaking, and he will be giving two 45-minute lectures. And then also on Saturday from 12 to 6, we have the Illinois Natural History Survey's 150th celebration, a natural history expo. And one of the things I forgot to mention about that is one of the features besides our scientists is the worldwide insect collection of Dan Capps. And this will be at least 40 tables of insects. And these are just, it's his personal collection, and it's just something to see.
Yeah, one other thing we're going to have there is a mounted ivory-billed woodpecker, which is something that most folks never get a chance to see. So come on out.
All right, thank you very much. Brian Anderson is the chief and director of the Illinois Natural History Survey, and entomologist Sue Post is along with us. She's an entomologist at the Illinois Natural History Survey.